Hello, everyone. So hi, I'm Lee Byron from Facebook, and I worked with Martin Wattenberg, who's at IBM, who you all knew. So earlier this year, the New York Times spun up a big debate, a controversy, if you will. And it wasn't about political bias. It wasn't about unnamed commentators. It was about this graph. This graph was lauded as fantastic and also unsavory. Really polarized comments that we got on this. So what I'm going to be talking about today, stacked graphs, geometry and aesthetics. It's the design process towards creating this graph and a couple other graphs like it. So the New York Times box office sales graph was put in print and on web. And on web was great because it gets picked up by the blogosphere, by Dig, by all these different online communities and talked about. We can scrape those comments out. We get all kinds of interesting things. So a whole bunch of pats on the back. This is awesome. Love pats on the back, right? But also some things that weren't so great. So we got these polarizing comments. Some people laud it as some of the best things they've seen, and some people just don't understand it, don't get it, and don't like it. But really, most of the comments that we find online are like this, which are pulling out information from the graph, talking about it, and having conversations around it, which is exactly the point of putting these things up in the first place. So anecdotal success, right? So this graph was produced first. This was about 2 years ago, a project of mine that inspired the New York Times graph. What I want to talk about today is the design process towards creating these. This one in particular is called Listening Histories. It graphs the personal listening trends of any given user of Last.fm. Last.fm is a service that remembers what song you listen to and when through iTunes, Winamp, your iPod, and through their own radio service. So it was a cool project. It got a lot of press. So the design process of creating these things, there are some goals that we have in mind. There are many time series that we need to represent, more than 1,000, so that's a pretty big scale. We want to create something organic and aesthetically pleasing, and I'll talk a little bit about that more, and evoke emotional reaction. So we're not looking for people to make scientific discoveries so much with these pieces, but instead react on an emotional level. So there's some things to keep in mind when doing these. The macro-micro principle by Ed Tufte. So this basically says that you should be able to look at the graph as a whole and gain some understanding about it, but also be able to look up close, see the details, and gain even more understanding about it. Banking the 45 degrees, it's William Cleveland who basically came up with this idea of how to scale a line graph so that you get optimal legibility. So we take that into account. And then this idea of aesthetics versus legibility, which is sort of a huge pull, and they always seem to be polar opposites, and I don't agree that they always are. But it's really all about the context in which these graphs are presented. So sometimes the aesthetic goals take over, and you may argue that they step into legibility. Things become less readable because they're becoming more aesthetic. But in particular context, that's perfectly okay. So when it's in a newspaper, it's really not so important that it's legible at all. It's important that people look at it. So as long as you can get someone's eyes on it, then you've accomplished your first goal. And then if you can get someone to read it, well, then that's great too. Obviously, we want to do both, but in this context, it's actually kind of interesting that the aesthetics are more important than legibility. So some considerations when going through this design process. The shape of the graph itself, the order in which you put the layers, the color choices that we make, and the way that we label the layers. So I'm going to talk about these in this order. When it comes to graph shape, we want to approach this unified theory of stacked graph geometry. This is something Martin Wattenberg whizzed up, and he did the math, so I'll do my best to try to explain it. So a stacked graph is a series of, usually time series, stacked on top of each other, which we could abstract to each layer being a function f, which is the thickness of that layer, stacked on top of a function g, which is the bottom edge of that layer. So this creates this relatively simple formula. That's the G line for any particular layer is the original G, the G0 of the whole graph, plus the summation of all of the layers underneath it up to that point, right? So that's a stacked graph. Well, this is kind of interesting because this makes clear all of the constraints of a stacked graph. It's pretty much entirely constrained except one variable, which is G0. So by changing G0, we can create a whole bunch of different geometries. So a traditional stack graph is where g of 0 equals 0. It's a perfectly flat bottom line. This is what we're used to seeing in stacked graph, and this is totally great. There's all kinds of benefits of having this. Most optimal benefit is the fact that we have a really easy way to read the summation of the entire graph. You could even put leader lines behind this and have it on a grid. But there are some things that it has as a downfall. The micro-readability of individual layers begins to suffer. So relatively recently, this was released, ThemeRiver. ThemeRiver has a little more interesting g of 0, in which g of 0 is the inverse of g of n, which would be the top of the graph, which this means is that it's symmetric along a center axis. This is great because it's still legible for reading the sum of the entire graph by reading along the top edge. If you just look at the two, all we're really doing is just squishing between, the scale drops a little bit. And it also does something that is really interesting. Any point along the silhouette of the graph as a whole is as close as possible to the center of the graph. So it's minimizing the sum of squares. This is fantastic for legibility. Although in our cases, when we're looking at many time series stacked into a graph, we don't necessarily want to just optimize the sum of squares, the slope of the layer, to the entire graph, but to each individual layer. So that's what we started trying to do. So if we minimize that local deviation, if we try to make each individual layer as flat as possible while still having no internal empty space, still following all the constraints of a stacked graph, we arrive at this. So this is minimizing all the local deviation. So this is sort of interesting. It's no longer symmetrical, and you see that large spikes don't offset the entire graph, but rather just sort of push off onto their own, not disrupting the other layers. So you see from here to here, we're now losing that sense of being able to read the sum of the entire graph by just looking at the top or the bottom edge. But that's a trade-off that we may be willing to make depending on the context of the graph. So this is all great. This can run in interactive time. It's actually very fast to calculate this. But there's one thing that it doesn't do. And that's thick layers and thin layers are being treated totally equal, where that may not be optimal. So a very thick layer may be something that visually in the graph should have more clout in how things get pushed around. So in order to do that, we have this idea of a weighted wiggle. This is sort of difficult because each layer gets thicker and thinner over time, or over x from left to right. That means that our equation is of g prime, so we have to use numeric integration when we actually draw this, which isn't as fast. So when you're doing a print piece, this works perfectly well. And when you're doing an interactive piece, then you would want to use this one that doesn't take into account the weight. And it's not quite as great, but it's still a step in the right direction. So I call this graph the stream graph. Sort of want to introduce it as the successor to ThemeRiver. It accomplishes some new goals, though. So here's the theme graph. And there are a couple of the things we need to talk about, right? So the way that we layer the orders. This may not be something that's immediately obvious, but what we're essentially doing is untangling a rat's nest. So if we have individual layers that are inside the graph that are very volatile, opening and closing in size dramatically, that's going to offset all of the other layers in the graph, and that's not going to be great for a design. This strategy is going to be based on the characteristics of the data. And usually when we're looking at these stacked graphs, the sort criteria for the layers isn't always totally relevant. So especially in the stack graphs where whether something is on top or on the bottom doesn't make quite as much of a difference in the design as a whole, sorting on some data-based reason doesn't always make sense. Instead, we want to sort based on the characteristics of the time series data. So here's a late-onset time series. What that means is that the domain of each layer is a subset of the domain of the entire graph. So each layer will start at zero and then eventually peak and then fall off. This is great because this perfectly models how movies happen. So when we're designing one for the box office sales, of course it's the case that a movie that hasn't been made yet isn't yet on the graph. At some point it releases in theaters, it peaks, it goes really high, and then it tails off. The same thing tends to happen with music listening, where someone has yet to discover an artist, they discover the artist, it peaks, they listen to it a lot, and then it sort of trends and fades off. So this is a a kind of data that I've been seeing a lot in these projects, so that's what we focus on. In order to sort this, we do this. So what we've basically done is set the onset of each one of these time series along the silhouette of the graph, along the outside. So how we do this is we sort by essentially saying, as we move from the left side to the right side, when we find a layer who has had its first non-zero number, we place it on the outside of the collection, so either at the very beginning of the collection or at the very end of the collection. So that's really, like, from this, which I'd argue is not that readable, to this, which I'd argue is much more readable, just from sorting the layers. So I think that's actually a very large consideration when doing these stack graphs, is how you sort them. So moving on, color choice. So there are a couple things that we want to do when choosing colors. I'd say primarily what we're trying to do is create local contrast. We want to have the ability to differentiate the layers from each other. In addition to that, we want to create the aesthetic quality that we're going for, the emotional context that we're going for. We want to make sure that the colors that we're choosing are representative to the story that we're trying to tell. Thirdly, tertiarily, we may want to highlight compound information. So this really isn't the most important thing, I would argue, because it may compromise the first two, and that's the only reason. So the things that we're going to highlight aren't new information, but it's just compound information that's already there in the graph, but we can just make it more apparent through the coloring schemes. So listening histories uses this two-dimensional gradient, of which it basically takes two variables that it has, the time of initial onset, which you could already read from the graph just by trying to find where it is from left to right, where its first non-zero is. And then the other axis of the color is the popularity of the musician, which you could correlate to the area of each individual layer. So these are things that you could already read from the graph, but we're just reiterating through color. So one is hue, and the other one is saturation. This is not a pure hue saturation chart. It only actually goes through half of the wheel, and it's sort of custom tailored. You can build a two-dimensional gradient in Photoshop and then just sort of pull along it, along these two axes. So this is actually really relevant to creating the emotional context for this piece, because it creates hot new trends along the outside, which makes sense, and cool core interests, things that people will listen to continuously, they started listening to and they continue to listen to. As sort of a contrary to that, the box office sales uses a totally different coloring scheme. It has one axis and it uses categorical colors. Because they're categorical colors, local contrast sort of falls apart, and we have to add in stroke lines between the layers in order to have them be differentiated. We do this because at the times when we print something, registration isn't always perfect. So when your red layer overlaps your green layer, then you get these weird offsets and it fuzzes everything together. So by adding the stroke lines in between, we sort of account for that. So by breaking this into groups, it makes it a little bit easier to parse over a little bit more quickly. And again, what we're showing here is just data that was already represented in the graph. It's the area of each individual layer, but we go ahead and color it anyhow to let you focus on the big things better. So after coloring, we want to be able to layer or label the layers. So there are two things that we're going for here. We want to describe every layer, which is a difficult thing, and we want to highlight the important layers. So two different strategies when it comes to labeling. So for the listening histories, this was a print, and a fairly large print. So print allows for variable font size. So for large graphs, we can use large labels. For small layers, we can use smaller labels. And for even the smallest layer, there is a label on there. It's just very small. So when you print, that's totally okay, because you can get really close, and those layers that you might not have seen otherwise, you can see the layer and its label when you get up close. This works fine for print. But for the box office sales, it's interactive. So what we do is we highlight the few things that we think are really important, which are either the blockbusters or things that acted differently than we thought that they may have. We highlight those. But it also allows for rollovers. So rollovers means that we've highlighted every layer. There's some other things that I want to talk about the labels, which is how you style them. So for the print piece, these are intentionally faded back. And that helps to have the labels not overpower the design itself. I think that's pretty important. The box office sales, this was a little more difficult to get because you're working with screen real estate. We couldn't stick the labels within the layers themselves. on with the screen real estate, but we still wanted to label them, so we just labeled less. I think it still starts to take over the graph. We didn't get perfect, but we got pretty close. So some conclusions and some questions that this design process sort of rises up. One conclusion is this unified approach to the stack graph layout, optimizing for distortion. And you could imagine using this sort of idea, you could optimize for a whole bunch of different aesthetic concerns. So it could be really interesting to see how other people take it. Balancing aesthetic and legibility trade-offs, which I talked about at the beginning. So that's considering the context of delivery and whether it's more important for the graph to be more legible or whether it's more important for the graph to be more aesthetically interesting. And this question, does stream graph make the overall graph harder to read, which was the main criticism that we got about this graph? And our answer is, does it matter? And this sort of goes back to the last question, which is the context of the graph. Are you actually trying to see the total sum sales of all box office sales over the last couple of years? And if so, our graph is probably not the way to do it. So we don't think that it does matter. Instead, you're trying to find the individual layers. You're trying to find the individual movies and how they did. And you want to see them in an aggregate where you could look at a whole bunch of different movies at the same time. So we feel that the design decisions led in a direction opposite from how stack graphs usually work, which led to this sort of criticism. Although this is still an open question, we haven't done formal user studies on this, so many of these questions still stand. So that's me. That's Stream Graphs. Myself, Lee Byron, Martin Wattenberg as well, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Hello, I'm Ben Schneiderman, University of Maryland. I loved this when I first saw it. I do note that it was really interesting, and I wanted you to reflect on the vertical versus horizontal layout, because in the printed version, which went the full length of the newspaper, all the film labels were inside their region. Whereas when you got to the web, you got to the horizontal, and then they just really fell apart for me. So I wondered why you didn't try a vertical.
Well, I think the listening histories graph was the original incantation of this method, and it was horizontal. And I don't think I ever really considered doing it vertically. It just seemed natural that you would read from left to right. So I stuck with the convention of reading from left to right. So when it came to do the piece for the Times, doing something across the full width of a page is very difficult to mesh in with the design of the paper. Every once in a while it happens, but you better have a major story in order to do that. So doing things in a quarter page, which is to say you open it up and then you have one page and then you have half of that, that's something that's real estate that's much easier to get. So we tweaked the design to fit that, and then we found that by scaling the design, squishing it this way and stretching it this way, the peaks, especially with the movie data, the peaks were very high. So when we rotated it, then we had sort of nice real estate to put the labels in. And when we translated that to the online piece, the labels didn't work quite as well. We worked with a couple of Flash guys that decided to keep it horizontal.
So this highlights nicely the distinctions between the advantages of doing it on paper and the different formats and electronically. But when you went to the on paper, I think it was a year and a half worth of data, or 2.5 years. Whereas electronically, you had 21 years or something like that. You had a much larger amount of data, which was great.
Right.
But the paging didn't allow me to do year-by-year comparisons. Did you consider the interactive nature of to allow the comparison if you had done a page bar that would let you page back so you could notice the regularity of summer blockbusters and December blockbusters? Mm-hmm. It would have been much – it seemed like an opportunity.
I totally agree with you, and I agree. We did think about that opportunity, like especially like when you first look at the data, you're like, wow, Thanksgiving is a peak, Christmas is a peak, and summer is a peak. It would be interesting to stack these up and see, you know, how they relate. And one of the first incantations of the piece for the press, or for the paper, sorry, we wanted to have multiple years. We wanted to do a decade, and we wanted to stack them on top of each other. We realized that the graphs were too small. It was a little too hard to read them, and we decided to just stick with about a year and a half's worth of data. Basically, what it came down to is when you run out of time. It's one thing in academia to say, like, we'll push another week on this, but in the Times when you say, like, we have 3 days to push this out the door. So it's one of those things where you always have a zillion ideas, And then you have to sort of get to the core idea of what it is that you're trying to tell with the story, and you push that.
So great piece of work.
I totally agree. In the if we had ever had a chance to do this, maybe next year, it would be better.
Great piece of work. Great.
Thank you.
Hi, Andy Wilson, Sandia National Labs. Could you go back a few slides to the web screenshot where you've got the labels?
That one.
Yep. I may be about to suggest heresy, but it occurred to me that you could take advantage of the fact that your new items always start on the silhouette and put your labels above and below the chart, possibly with short lines to call them out. I agree with you that in this case, the labels in their dark type tend to overwhelm the graph. And apart from making the labels wiggle down in, it seems like getting them out of the way entirely might be a way to overcome the clutter.
So we actually tried that. And what we ran into was, first off, that not all of the peaks aren't followed by a larger peak. So sometimes the layer did overlap the graph. Other times, many of the peaks are at about the same level, mm-hmm. in which case the labels overlap themselves. So we had to either move the label up, which moved it further away from the top edge of the point, in which case it was harder to understand what the point was relevant to, or we moved mm-hmm. it down, in which case it was back into the layer again, and then confounded these problems. What I think we sort of did wrong was have too many labels. The design decision behind that was we want people to glance at it, get a great understanding, then move to another page. We don't expect people to sit here more than 10 seconds. So that's sort of why it ended up being that way. I don't totally agree with that design decision. I think that's a great strategy. If we were to highlight like 3 instead of 30 and then do that, I think that would have been much more elegant. I would have opted for that. But that would have implied that people would have spent more than 30 seconds, more than a minute, sort of digging around to see the other things that are interesting.
And clearly the fact that there's 300 odd labeling papers suggests that we're not going to come up with the solution in a 60-second question. This is beautiful work. Thank you.
Thanks.
Carlos Scheidegger, University of Utah. A quick question about if you switch between show the slides when you reorder them to reduce sort of the squiggling between both of them from this one. Yeah. So this one definitely wiggles a lot less. And I was thinking if you could just directly optimize for banking to 45 degrees, so sort of picking your G0 and the ordering such that it just straight minimizes the whole thing throughout, and if it would look something like that. Just a quick question, because then you'd know it's the one that wiggles the last, right?
So one thought was to, after doing the sort, to then scale this graph by basically saying, like, what are all the slopes of all of the layers, and then how do we find the average, and then how do we use that to account to figure out what the best aspect ratio of the graph is. The problem is that most of these were done in print.
Yeah.
And so in print, you basically have a stat paper size to work with, and you have to sort of mesh around that. So
that was sort of my question. Is because you have a limited aspect ratio, you could instead optimize the G0 so that within that aspect ratio, they do bank to 45 degrees.
I understand. We didn't try that. That's actually a good idea.
Thanks very much.
Thanks.